This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. Thanks so much for joining us tonight for Beyond the Act after the Biennale. The idea of tonight's event is fairly kind of simple. We want to introduce you to some of the projects that have been staged in Venice during this current architecture biennale. And then we want to also have a somewhat organic conversation about how these ideas that we're presenting in our respective exhibitions there can be mobilized in the service of a contemporary practice. There's an uncertainty today, I think, about how we ought to live and what our place should be and how architects can help shape that sense of place. There were two things that we very much wanted to emphasize. One, we didn't really want to feature celebrity architects in the US Pavilion. And two, we wanted to emphasize a collaborative model of practice. We wanted to question a more modernist approach that kind of fetishizes individual authorship.
So I wanted to start maybe contextualizing a bit what is Venice, not in the sense what is the city, but what is the Venice Biennale as a platform to discuss architecture. The Biennale is an institution that is more than a century old, where I don't know if a lot of you went there, but actually it's divided in different venues. It's a big garden in which each country has one pavilion. What's actually quite interesting about this, the pavilions, like the American pavilion that you just saw, they're actually nationally owned. So each pavilion is a territory of a different country hosted temporarily in Venice. That is something like an embassy somehow. So each country can decide in an autonomous way how they want to make their presentation. But also the Biennale, has, as an institution, has two large venues. One that is the Arsenale, that is a very large series of buildings where the Serenissima, the government of Venice, used to make the ships that would go on war all over and conquer basically all Europe and the Mediterranean. And actually, the other venue is inside the Giardini. There is a large pavilion. It's the largest pavilion in the Giardini. That is called Padiglione Italia. That is actually the place where the Biennale is presenting itself. This year, the director of the entire show, of the entire Biennale, was an American critic called Aaron Betsky. Betsky is the director of the Cincinnati Art Museum. And he defined a title that was called, it's called Out There, Architecture Beyond Building. So he tried to see in which way architecture could be defined without necessarily talking about building itself, but so talking about architecture in a much more cultural and wide way. Betsky made a presentation in the Arsenale asking 20 architects to make installations. So basically you will have a series of installations made by what he thought were the most relevant architects today that go from Frank Gehry, Zadid, Azimtot, and so on. And basically those installations are places where you navigate through. And, well, actually, I was curating this experimental architecture exhibit that was in the other pavilion. Is it confusing? Is it clear? Basically, what happened in this experimental exhibit, I tried to put together all the examples that I thought were more relevant, conceiving what could be conceived for architecture today in the sense of which practices are defining in a better way a new language for architecture. So there are 55 groups, and I tried to kind of a posteriori define which were the main categories. And I thought I actually could foresee six different attitudes. And these attitudes are mostly concerning ecology, so usually architects that are trying to define new urban ecologies, architects that are using reuse to make structures. So basically there are architects that are not really building buildings with new materials, but they're reusing old materials to make buildings. Or objects, or anything else. There are another group of architects working pretty much on social issues. So they're defining, in general, defining society as their scope. So they're not so much interested in making like a house, but they're actually interested in stimulating a program, stimulating a way of working together. And that's actually, I think, the kind of work that were actually much more present in the American pavilion and were probably the main scope of this pavilion. Another group of architects are working pretty much in this kind of situationist way. So they were using games and a playful manner to understand and to define what the city is, and then maybe also to define new creative issues to redesign the city. Another group was very much interested in public space. So there are actually groups that are trying to activate new uses of public space. So defining the public space not anymore as a shopping mall, but kind of defining all the possibilities that the public space could actually define. And I always forget one. I always get to five. So maybe six is not the right number. So... I'll get there. So the sixth one was actually people that are working very much with visions. So they're defining new, visions and images in which you can see how architecture will form our environment. So what's interesting about using images is that actually can be a very strong way to impress in which direction things are developing, and so to be aware of how things can be done differently. Today, considering that here we're talking mostly about the social perspective, I wanted to show two works that somehow will contextualize this entire selection. What I think is interesting, and what actually came out from the Biennale in general, is that there's a huge amount of people, mostly young architects, that are really trying to redefine the role of the architect. So they're not simply understanding the architect as a designer that is designing a building, but actually they're trying to redefine the entire role of the architect as a person that can go beyond this idea of making buildings, but it can actually be the one that is activating an understanding and activating a process. So the idea that the process becomes the main subject of architecture is, I think, a very strong and emerging thing, not only within the selection that I made, but within many, many other works within the Biennale. So I wanted to talk mostly about two works. So within how does an architect redefine the field of action? I think one of the interesting works, mostly because it's really reshaping the role, is the work of Santiago Sirugueda. Santiago is an architect from Sevilla, and this that you're seeing is actually a work that he did for public space while he was in college. He was asked to make a work in his home city, but he couldn't really find the idea of doing something that was not specifically involving the people of the neighborhood. So he went to his neighborhood, and he asked people what actually they needed. And they said, well, you know, we mostly have everything, but we don't really have things that will make us use public space. So he went to the municipality and asked if he could design things for elements for public space, and the municipality actually said that it was not possible because it was too costly, and it was not really possible for a citizen to propose things. So he said, but what about if I just put a dumpster, you know, like the ones in which you put the waste material for a restoration of a building. And they said, well, you know, you just have to fill a form and then you can do it. So he found 12 dumpsters, and he filled up his neighborhood with this kind of spontaneous and temporary places, one with a garden with some trees, some with seats and some benches, and another with the toys for kids. So he's actually squatting the space and finding a legal loophole to use differently public space. This is again is another. He usually is using very cheap material, and what is really interesting, I think, of his attitude is that he's actually involved in many projects all over Spain, and actually now even in Italy, in which people are asking for a kind of structure, and he's actually designing a structure and providing people information and instructions so they can actually build it themselves with very poor material. This, like for instance, is a project for a housing. So basically, he's giving people instructions like this. It's like an IKEA kit, in which actually you can build your own house in on the roof of your building. So what is interesting about this project is not so much that you will solve the problems of housing in any city, but what is interesting is that these projects get really involved in a kind of awareness campaign. So it's about squatting temporarily at public spaces in which in actually temporarily nothing is done, and building structures in which people can temporarily live. The idea is also that it's all these projects are starting mostly because to raise the awareness on the fact that our cities are mostly places of segregation. So you see that mostly less wealthy people live in the outskirts, well, in Europe. Here, sometimes it's the opposite. So people, less wealthy people live in the downtowns. And so to avoid the segregation of part of the population in different parts of the city, he's proposing to squat temporarily places. And actually, people can actually do these things by themselves. So an interesting project is, for instance, a project in which he...
Do you need audio?
Yeah. Is there? I can just put it here.
This is here.
Is that wrong? Okay. So basically, he put an announcement on a newspaper asking people to contact him in case they wanted to build a temporary structure on the roof of another house, so really squatting space. So basically, he made this video to show how easy it is, and his Recetas Urbanas is providing all the material to do it. He's providing the instruction to build it, but also he's providing legal assistance because he's working also as an artist. So basically, these works are protected with this kind of copyright of an artwork. So this shows how day by day, beginning with building a crane, you can build your temporary structure. So this is a day later. It takes 4 days, basically, to... Something wrong with the audio, I'm sorry, but...
Sounds good.
So basically, after you build in your structure, they're having a barbecue on their rooftop.
That's so great.
So actually...
So weird.
What is quite amazing of this project is, of course, not so much that you're building a temporary structure, but that these projects usually conquer the first pages of the local newspaper. So with these actions, you somehow raise awareness on a problem. This was a picture in Barcelona in a neighborhood called Poble Nou. And as you see, these buildings are completely built with really cheap materials that usually are simply building materials that are configured in another way. I think I'm running a bit late, right? So how long is it? So I would probably stop here.
Yeah.
So basically, We were talking before, we were discussing a bit before of what are the things that could be interested for you guys to hear about Venice. You probably would know that, would be probably interesting to know that basically the idea is that of the exhibit in Venice is also that it's one of the few places where you can discuss architecture in a wide way. So the idea of the Biennale is that to put together all different perspectives on architecture and to start a discussion, and also to start a way to discuss which is a way to present architecture. Of course, architecture is mostly about, it's something that is, it's quite difficult to talk about. So a lot of the presentation, in this case, in the Biennale, are of course concerning ways of engagement and ways in which you can discuss what architecture is in a wider perspective. So the idea of this exhibit are really to make like somehow a platform in which different ideas are presented and in which different methodologies can be confronted. Of course, the scope of all these of all this presentation is also somehow to confront different attitudes. And so what I thought was quite interesting is that in the different ways of working of these architects, like in the exhibit itself, you would see completely different mediums. So you would see like works like the work of Teddy Cruz that was also in my exhibit presented. You will see that everyone is using different techniques. And what I think was quite a striking is that you would see that nowadays the most different tools are developed to talk about these issues. And like most of the times, even tools or media like video or like ways of talking about things like a commercial language can become very important ways to present questions and present like and are used as methods of engagement.
Oh, yeah. I will close it here.
The American Pavilion started out with a conversation with Teddy Cruz and myself, developed into something a little more complicated, but I think originally, from my point of view, Teddy can talk about his own work and what he brought to this process. By the way, the whole American Pavilion was very much the process of selecting the groups, trying to figure out how to display them, arrange them in the pavilion was very much a collaborative effort, just as the kind of work we were showing is in its own professional way of working, so that we had lots of arguments and discussions and debates about the whole process. When we first did the proposal, from my point of view, I knew that Aaron Betsky's had been chosen to head the whole Biennale. It's a little complicated. There's one person that's over this kind of whole architectural Biennale, which includes, as Emiliano described, the Italian Pavilion, the Arsenale, and a couple other buildings. That's one exhibition. And then inside this Giardini, there are these other buildings, which are all national pavilions. And each of the pavilions basically does what it wants. But oftentimes, there's a kind of dialogue between the national pavilions and this greater theme. So I knew Aaron Betsky had been picked. I knew what his title was, which is something like Out There, and it was about practice. It was architecture beyond building. I'd heard that he'd said that he wanted to have an architectural biennale without a single building. And I had the sense, I think wrongly now, after meeting Emiliano and seeing what he had done, that what was really going to be presented would have been what I would consider very formal architecture, which is very much about form as opposed to the kind of process of creating the architecture. It turns out, however, that Aaron was smart enough to bring Emiliano into the process, and he brought in a lot of these collaborative practices that had some of the same kind of working processes that Teddy Cruz and Deborah Gans, who was a sort of another addition to the project, brought into the American Pavilion. So we had this discussion about bringing these different groups in. What interested us was the way, as Emiliano described, all these different practices sort of look at being an architecture in a different kind of way than just a professional who sits in an office and waits for someone to come with a commission and then put the project up. Of course, it's not really how architecture works, but these different projects really sit down and sort of think about what it is they're going to do. And one of the things that I realized, I think, that might be slightly different than what I think some of the other practices in Europe, which have affinities with our work, what's unique about ours was a kind of real entrepreneurial approach that the American groups take. I think it's a something forced on American architecture, you know, at least since the time of Reagan, and a kind of attitude that social space is private, that all social services are meant to be provided by the family, et cetera, and a kind of withdrawal of any kind of governmental participation in the equation of political space, of social space, rather. So all these groups go out and sort of find a problem, on one hand, work in different kinds of ways to think about what the problem is. They don't just come and plop a building down on it. Teddy can show you some of his projects in Tijuana and San Diego and Southern California, and now New York, where the work evolves out of a discussion between the communities where it's being placed and the architect, and that's what the architect's role is. So it's very, this entrepreneurial sense is very much like, well, let's say Alice Waters, as you know, is a famous chef with Chez Panisse in Berkeley, who went out and found a school, which, like many schools in the post-Reagan era, were very troubled in terms of funding and the kind of, it was sort of a pre-gentrification period, and this school actually met some people who went to Martin Luther King Middle School where this garden took place. She ripped out the garden and planted a vegetable garden. So our little garden was sort of a representation of this whole process that the edible schoolyard went through, where they ripped out the tarmac, the basketball courts, planted organic vegetables, the kids plant the vegetables, they grow the vegetables are served in the cafeteria. She took a kind of traditional high school or middle school cafeteria and painted it like ochre walls. It looks like Chez Panisse with little framed pictures of mushrooms all in French on the wall. The kids eat with cloth napkins and tablecloths. It was very funny. We're trying to explain to the some of the Italian interns who we left behind to walk people through the process this issue about obesity and overweight in America and how it's a kind of can be seen as a kind of class problem. And it was sort of lost on the Italians, but we all know it's something that's very important here. So Alice Waters has really, you know, decided that was a problem. What's interesting to us, of course, is she spatialized it. I mean, she's not an architect, but it had a spatial component, you know, where this is the architecture biennale, after all, so we're dealing with space. She sort of spatialized this, created this whole process where these kids engage with it, and to her credit, she's had many people come along and say, oh, this is a great idea, we should do it all over America. And she says, no, I just want to work with this one school. So for 12 years, she's been working in this one middle school, you know, bringing the questions of slow food, you know, the kids eat with table on a tablecloth, cloth napkins, they're meant to eat very slow. So she really engages in that whole process. That's the kind of entrepreneurial kind of approach that we took. Now, there were 16 different practices in the American Pavilion. Most of them were architects. There were architects, one who decided that New York should have a floating swimming pool and spent 12 years creating that. There were a couple projects in there that the end product is a kind of display or a kind of art exhibition. Teddy, I think, should talk about this because he was sort of very adamant from the beginning that he's not an artist. And I think a lot of our practitioners felt that way. You know, they're not artists. They're architects engaging with real problems and real issues. But we are in a biennale, so we had to figure out a way to sort of make these things explicit. And Teddy, we forced him to put this screen out on the front, which we think was an incredible project, but he kind of felt it didn't really describe the process that he's going through. The rest of them, we tried to sort of describe this process. Now, the last thing I wanted to say about this particular way of looking at architecture is that, from my point of view, it's not a completely new proposition. People like Teddy and Deborah Gans, who did these roll-up houses, and other people, I think, really are bringing a new professional a practice into a kind of old equation and sort of updating it. But this issue of architecture developing from a kind of discussion with the participants, as opposed to architects simply dropping the project into a space, goes back at least, let's say, 80 years to the introduction of modernism into the United States. I, in addition to the Architects newspaper, teach city planning and architecture at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, and I usually end up teaching architecture to planning students and planning to architecture students. So I'm like right there on the edge. I'm really interested in those architectural practices that engage with community. And this came out of being a student at Berkeley in the 1960s and being a participant in People's Park and being engaged with all kinds of alternative art groups like Ant Farm and Super Studio from Italy and Archigram. But I was really influenced a lot by the critic Lewis Mumford, who was part of the 1932 Museum of Modern Art exhibition called Modern Architecture, sometimes called the International Style Show, where modern architecture was introduced to the United States for the very first time by Henry Russell Hitchcock and Philip Johnson as a new style. It was a purely formal style. It was very reductive. It was white walls, flat roofs. Mumford really was upset by that presentation. He'd been to Europe. He traveled and seen Bruno Taut Siedlungen in Germany and some of Korb's early workers' housing projects. And he was really offended by that kind of thinking about architecture. He said architects should not be worried about the correct order of the columns, you know, Corinthian, Ionic, and Doric. They should be creating communities. And they had a big symposium at the Museum of Modern Art in 1932 where Hitchcock presented their notion of the exhibition. And right there in the front row were Nelson Rockefeller and Conyer Goodyear and all the people who started the Museum of Modern Art. And Mumford got up and said, architects need to design as if they're designing for a communist government. And it basically like cut him out of MoMA for the rest of his life. They didn't want to have anything to do with him. but he was really upset about this presentation of the formalism of architecture. He was looking at Ernst Mies, Romestadt Siedlung in Frankfurt, and these incredible housing projects that were done in the post-World War II period. And he felt that this new style was grew out of, you know, I don't want to get into it too much, but the kind of issues that were going on, the need for housing in places like Germany after World War I, and the new technological possibilities of mass-produced housing, of factory-built housing, and that architecture needed and did come up out of that. So teaching city planning, as I do, to architecture students, I'm always trying to get over to them this kind of history that we've all shared for the last 80, 90 years in America. And then they go into their studios, and their studio teachers tell them just the opposite, you know, not to pay any attention to all the stuff that I'm saying in there. but the one last thing that I wanted to say, and then I'll pass it on to Teddy, is that one of the mistakes, I think, that the community architects and the city planners made was in their sort of rush to move away from physical form and move towards an engagement with community, they forgot about physical form. And I've seen lots of worthy projects being created all over New York. My favorite is the Nehemiah Project, if any of you know that, in Brooklyn in the South Bronx, that are just horrible, just hideous. And the city planners promote this stuff all the time. The groups that we picked, like Rural Studio is perhaps the best example of this, do extraordinary, extraordinary, extraordinary architecture for places that don't ordinarily get that kind dedication and beauty, really. And I felt that the groups we picked all brought that back to the planning community development community that need to hear that. They need to hear that those people in the South Bronx should be given housing as good as what they would want to live in themselves. So that's what attracted me to bringing in a lot of these groups. Teddy might have had another sense of that as an architect. I'm not really an architect, but a historian, so I see it a little bit differently. So maybe you could talk a little bit about your...
Yes, and I think I can pick up just by diving sort of into the image that I was lucky to hang as a facade for the U.S. Pavilion, which for me was an amazing treat to imagine that I would bring one of the most contested borders in the world, at least the image of it, to be the facade of the U.S. Pavilion, primarily in the context of the current, you know, sociopolitical climate here in the United States. You don't imagine when the representative from the State Department was inaugurating the pavilion, outside the pavilion, the backdrop for him was that border. And so for me, it was an amazing moment, mainly because, of course, I witness and experience this border every day in the place where I work, San Diego, Tijuana. And so, but besides being just an emblematic image, which ultimately for me it is in terms of my practice at this very specific locality, it's also an operative image that really has produced a very different approach, a set of procedures that have redefined my role as an architect working in this very contested, volatile space, this territory. I many times think that this laboratory that has become the border between Tijuana and San Diego, for me, is in, the place where in 60 linear miles you can compress some of the most critical issues that are redefining our debate in terms of architecture and urbanism towards the territory, and ultimately redefining our role, as I'm saying, in terms of our procedures. And that primarily was one inspiration to frame, let's say, the exhibition inside the pavilion. What are really the procedures behind our practice? How are we redefining our tools? How are we repositioning ourselves in the context of these conditions of crisis and conflict? And ultimately, how are we reorganizing the resources that might make it possible to deploy and produce new types of architectures? We began, we thought, okay, that sounds like a great idea. Let's hang the wall 90 feet long billboard. I mean, it was an amazing opportunity. And then let's call it radicalizing the local, 60 linear miles of transborder conflict. And in a sense, that's what becomes important about the image, is to suggest or begin the show that was inside the pavilion with the necessity to return to the local, but not out of the kind of folkloristic, nostalgic ideas about regionalism, but really to radicalize it in a way that we really begin to expose the conditions of crisis or conflict that have been generated in the territory itself, and allow that moment of exposure be an operational device to redefine our practice. So for me, that has been the essence in my practice, and I began to then construct this photographic cross-section of that territory, 30 miles in San Diego, 30 miles across the border into Tijuana. I began to realize that in these 60 linear miles of conflict is where some of the most, again, incredible and intensive conditions really are at play at this moment. The politics of labor and surveillance and of immigration, the conflicts or struggles between formal and informal urbanisms, the tension between sprawl and density, and probably the most dramatic of them all, the radical proximity of mega wealth and rampant poverty. And when you begin to see that in 30 miles deep into San Diego, away from the border, some of the wealthiest real estate in the world is found, and barely 20 minutes away from it, we can find some of the poorest settlements in Latin America. I mean, that proximity between enclaves of mega wealth and redevelopment and the sectors of service, the service communities that feed that project, that wealthy project with cheap labor, is really what is redefining more and more the post 9/11, I think, a city everywhere from Dubai to New York to Tijuana, San Diego. So in that context, that photographic section begins 30 miles into San Diego, where we find, again, along the 60 linear miles, places where the collision of artificial and natural ecologies, top-down and bottom-up dynamics, again, collide. And the suggestion was it is, in fact, in those places of collision across those many conflicts where architectures or architects should place themselves. And so we began, let's say, with the conflict between top-down development and the topography, where you find, developers in Southern California demolishing the differential of the topography everywhere to install this cheap project of McMansions everywhere, and then moving into the conflict between large freeway infrastructure and the watershed everywhere across Southern California, the conflict between gated communities and everyday life, or as my friend Rebecca Solnit called it, the apartheid of everyday life in the McMansions that are being built everywhere in Southern California. One radical one, the conflict between military bases and environmental zones. In Southern California, as you know, primarily in San Diego, the only places where there is no development is where the military bases exist. And then the conflict, of course, between the formal and the informal, as we find many San Diego neighborhoods being completely retrofitted by immigrants in the last 50 years, and the conflict between two cities that ignore each other even though they juxtapose themselves simultaneously. And the conflict, as soon as we cross the border, is an amazing, dramatic sight. The San Diego, the Tijuana River enters in the east part of Tijuana, enters the city, divides Tijuana in two, and then pierces the border wall, entering into San Diego again, and finally arriving to the Pacific Ocean. So that place where the river and the border collide almost tangentially is one of the, I would call it the mama of conflicts, is a conflict between the natural and the political. And this is a place exactly where the checkpoint is positioned, which is very ironic. Then the conflict between the informal and the natural ecologies, as we find many of these shanty towns encroaching into the natural canyons as well, and the conflict between factories and housing or emergency housing and cheap labor out of NAFTA, the conflict of density and the sprawl as the McMansions of San Diego are reproducing Tijuana in miniature, and ultimately as we arrive to the Pacific Ocean, or the wall actually arrives into the Pacific Ocean, finally sinking, the conflict between the natural, again, and the political. So the backdrop for this section of the territory was that exact moment where the wall arrives to the Pacific Ocean and finally sinks. So this, of course, has been the most emblematic image. And finally, just to contextualize it, if we, Aaron, I don't know how to move to the next image. If we contextualize it to a challenge, or at least a homework that I gave to myself, which I had many times in the discussion with the curators of the pavilion, I tried to imagine how this exhibition could be organized. And this is a topic that we might discuss or not, but this issue of display. I mean, how do you really tell the story behind, without being too over didactic, how do you tell the story behind these practices? So I gave myself the challenge of explaining through a very naive and very simple diagram, in a way, the issues that have been important for my practice. If I was to explain really what is behind my desire in terms of redefining my role within this context of conflict. So on one hand is really the idea that practice faces conflict or confronts conflict, reveals it, exposes the conditions that produce conflict, mainly because when we think of emergency housing or social housing or many of these projects that nonprofit organizations really produce to relieve the condition of crisis, that's all we can achieve. Let's provide housing as a Habitat for Humanity might do. Let's just build houses. But we are not building communities. We are not really ultimately even constructing environmentally responsible sites. So in a sense, instead of just really being preoccupied with relief, temporal relief, we need to expose the conditions that produce that conflict in the first place, allowing that to be the material, possibly to reorganize the resources. So let's face it, right, as a practice, all of us. Right now, unprecedented crisis of environmental sustainability, crisis of public infrastructure, crisis of institutional collaborations, crisis of socioeconomic sustainability, crisis of housing affordability, crisis of political engagement. I would just say this morning, actually, Aaron, in his effort always to educate me a little bit, he gave me two books. And one of them, why, was Sigmund Bauman, and I just was skimming through it in La Colombe, which I love to, whenever I come here, to have a really the only real cappuccino in the United States. And he described the political as the ability to decide the purpose and direction of action. And I thought that was a perfect way of putting to rest this issue. It's like, okay, you are an architect or a politician. I mean, I'm not interested in those categories. The point is that all of us need to engage the political as we have to really decide what is really ultimately the purpose and the direction of our actions. So in the end, again, facing conflict and practice and research then becomes a tool to expose conflict. And we then, I feel, I've been interested in interpreting practice as a series of tactics of translation as we expose the conditions of power inscribed in the very territory. Because as architects, they've been teaching us just to dump our buildings in the territory without any regard to understanding the actual power, economic and political, that is inscribed in that territory. So the tactics of translation, primarily, I think, in my practice, are interested in revealing conditions of ownership, who owns the resources, and conditions of political jurisdiction, whose territory is it in the first place. And then from there, I think I began to realize that the interest is really the realization, of course, that we are operating within the context of fragmented institutions. Policies, resources, and budgets, all fragmented. So the possibility that a practice could engage the designing, the redistribution of resources and collaborations, that for me has been an essential issue, that we as architects, besides designing buildings, could also be designing political and economic process, and ultimately collaboration across jurisdictions and agencies to produce, hopefully, alternative economic performance. If you really think about it, the whole city is defined. The performer of the developer from stadiums, luxury condos, and the franchises that surround them is what defines any downtown right now from New York to San Diego. How to really create alternative performance that might suggest that a neighborhood itself is a developer of affordable housing, or alternative policy frameworks. The way we define density is just an amount of inhabitants or dwellings per acre. In many of these neighborhoods that have become the laboratory for my practice, density is different. Density can be measured as an amount of socioeconomic exchanges per acre. So the representation of the city begins to change. And finally, alternative spatial tactics, because after all, we are architects in a sense, and from this analysis, a new spatial configuration might emerge, and so on. And finally, of course, the idea that architects in this context mediate between the top-down and the bottom-up, the formal and the informal, economic capital, and ultimately social capital, the capturing of hidden value, which we might talk later about. But anyway, this diagram for me became an important tool in the context of the show, even though it was not displayed in the show. But I thought, well, wouldn't it be amazing that those 16 practices would explain themselves, could explain the procedures behind what they do, and that's what we really exchange. What we exchange is not only images of the final product, but the way we are producing a very different idea of action.
Thank you, Teddy. Thank you, Emiliano. Thank you, Bill. We have about 30 minutes left, and what I thought was maybe we could just have a fairly organic kind of conversation that would then open up to a conversation with all of you. One question that we had talked about briefly today was the question of spectacularity. As a curator, as one who's not an architect and who's had the pleasure to be somewhat liminal in relationship to the field, it seems that the projects that we've selected, for at least for the U.S. Pavilion, are decidedly not spectacular, or at least not on the level of form, on the level of the built infrastructure. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about how you define spectacularity, and in a certain sense, if you would agree with this kind of European response that we seem to have had, that the U.S. Pavilion seems quite oddly humble in a certain sense today, as opposed to past pavilion exhibits.
Well, I think this is an extremely difficult question because you're raising the discussion on many, many different notions. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the spectacle, it's something that itself, it's a very difficult notion to define. What we've seen recently is that, and I think this we could say quite easily, is that architecture has, with its spectacle, the spectacle of architecture has gained more and more attention on the media. So I think maybe the most emblematic building that at least over the last years gained attention was the Frank Gehry Bilbao Guggenheim. And what is, I think, quite incredible is that this building was overrepresented, was on commercials, was on every magazine, even much beyond the magazines of architecture. But then, again, if you go on Flickr and you Flickr Guggenheim Bilbao, you see only images of kind of fragments of titanium and people standing in front of it. So the image of architecture itself is something that is extremely contrasting, also in its spectacle, because what it's used mostly, it's this kind of shiny, glossy image. But then what is lived, even the same architecture itself, is completely different. Mm-hmm. You can talk about this, the building of Bilbao, as the representation of a huge process of rebuilding a city, an industrial city that was on the collapse, and decided to invest on culture. But this is not what actually is not the story that is coming through. The story is mostly how beautiful this only pick of seeing the building from one perspective is making architecture become. So I think that it's quite tricky talking about spectacularization, because as I think is also interesting to note, the spectacle can also be inverted. Mm-hmm. So the spectacle cannot be only seen as the kind of the spectacle of the beauty, but I think that actually the facade of the pavilion, of the American pavilion this year, was strongly spectacular. Mm-hmm. It was the spectacle of another meaning. And what is quite interesting, I think, and you could also read it within the rhetorics of Teddy, the rhetorics in the positive sense, mm-hmm. is that a lot of practitioners are today trying to find a way in which to talk in an attractive way about issues that are usually not on the front page of the news. And what is also quite interesting, and I think actually Bill described it in an incredibly thoughtful way, is that architecture has always had this ambivalence. So what is called international style was a moment in which, for the first time, actually was unprecedented in history, architects were asked to design buildings that would host 30,000 people or neighborhoods just in a go. So rebuilding after the Second World War Europe was, and rebuilding the huge urban developments in the United States was, for the first time, a challenge for architecture to face the organization of society. Before, architects were mostly building large buildings, but they never had the techniques to build this huge, massive neighborhoods and construction. And if you read well through the writings of most of the modern architects, starting from what Le Corbusier wrote for the construction of l'Unité d'Habitation, that was the first huge building in Europe, he actually is talking about building a new society and building a building that could host different social organizations. So there was a school, there was a story for the community itself. What actually happened was that the builders, or actually what went through, was to build the building. So to build the hardware, I usually say. So we built the hardware, but we never had the software to run the building itself. So something that went within that would help the community to use this huge infrastructure as something that was functional to build the community. So I think that more than showing a contrast between architects that are just interested in form and architects that are more interested in building community, so from on one side the spectacle, mm-hmm. and on the other side the social, mm-hmm. I think that actually today we should be looking at how the spectacle can be used to make social, or simply think about architecture in a completely integral way. So architecture that could simply go beyond the structure itself and can actually see life as the final scope.
We've been talking about a very expanded idea of practice in a way that's been something that both pavilions share quite explicitly. Could we also talk about the limits of design? I know that, Teddy, for instance, for you, the architect is quite literally empowered as a developer. For you, Bill, I know that we've had quite a few conversations that have registered some hesitancy about the architect being defined as a developer. Maybe could we talk about the limits of design, not just the empowered, expanded idea of architecture, architect as activist that we have here, but also in a way the risks that it carries when the architect becomes an activist but also an artist, a curator.
The history of architects as developers has been very mixed in the United States. Most of them ended up like Charles Bullfinch designing Boston going broke and John Portman famously went bankrupt as well. It's a kind of risky game. On the other hand, as Ted Smith showed in San Diego, you know, with the right kind of putting together of all the different elements of design, something quite extraordinary can be accomplished. Of course, the Adams Brothers did that in London. They also went bankrupt. The whole history of it is really mixed, but I think it's another kind, maybe added together with another attitude. Ted Smith seems to like really be obsessed about, you know, trying to bring density to San Diego. He's had to fight the zoning to create these denser pockets in San Diego, and the building of it is just a way to make that happen. Of course, he could end up going bankrupt someday as well. But he's, you know, I just want to, I think maybe to reiterate this notion of entrepreneurship, which is, you know, imposed on us perhaps by our own economic system and the way you need to work to be creative. It's an incredible, you know, way to kind of go out and actually make something happen. It's very risky, and I think there are very few people that are doing it, but a couple of the different groups, you know, in our show have done that. So it's, I don't know, I just think it's a mixed bag. But maybe it's joined up with a lot of other things. Teddy's maybe trying to do this in Hudson a little bit. It's trying to find new ways to operate. I mean, that's one of the things that's so interesting. Teddy's talking about developing out of conflict, which is, you know, fascinating notion. Some of the architects are doing it in different kinds of ways, but it's just trying to be, you know, think of a new way to sort of do the old, the thing that architects want to do. And architects, I think, always, it's an amazing profession, I think, because architects are really good people. You know, they all want the city to work and they want it to succeed, but you just can't sit back and wait for it to happen. And these individuals, whether it's a swimming pool or housing in Tijuana, San Diego, or housing for hurricane victims, tries to go out and, you know, find a new way to solve an old problem. And there are financial problems with trying to do it.
I mean, obviously, again, we find ourselves at a very interesting juncture. And I think, if anything, I agree definitely with Emiliano about the danger of polarizing, you know, the issues in such a way, in terms of the spectacular versus a more kind of more socially oriented project, and in many other kind of gradations in terms of how we tend to create camps, you know, primarily in our academic milieu and also practice and so on. But what I'm thinking, then, this need to expand our own frameworks of operation would suggest that the possibilities that design, while at this moment I find it suspicious that design is everywhere. I mean, it's like no other time I think we've been living where everybody, you know, there is so much good taste out there, you know. But we have been so very distant from the, you know, the issues that really are behind much of this situation, really, that afflicts us at this moment. I find it, I mean, I don't want to polarize the star architects versus, you know, the rest. What bothers me is just to see how our establishment, our architecture institutions are flocking to Asia, to China and Dubai primarily, you know, to operate unconditionally without, you know, questioning much of these conditions of power. I mean, how to really engage power and in so doing engaging the possibilities of counter procedures that might allow us to really produce different, you know, alternative agendas. So yes, it's about appropriating the spectacular, you know, and to really bring up the drama that also the socio-political and economic project conveys. I think that that's part of this expanded notion, possibly. It's very destabilizing or kind of dramatic when we think that 90% of the world's wealth is in the hands of 1% of its population, of the planet's population. When we see Damien Hirst, you know, selling his work for the last 2 years for $200 million and Sotheby's turns into the most incredible gallery in the world, and at the same time, the same week, the market is collapsing you know, in Wall Street. I mean, all of these very surreal and very dramatic and, in fact, spectacular conditions would call into action a very different set of procedures. So I think that if anything, in my case, when I think of the expanded notion of practice, is to suggest that, again, while design is everywhere, is not really deploying its most fundamental possibilities, which really suggests the reorganization of the values and the conditions that organize and construct power. And so I think that an expanded notion of design would be that design also can be everywhere, but from a different vantage point. And I would reiterate, we've been absent as architects from calling the shots. You know, what was the last time that any of you went to this city council chamber, whether in Philadelphia or San Diego, to really participate of the decisions that are ultimately constructing the city? And I think that the recuperation of certain, access to the political discussion, without becoming politicians necessarily, but just to really engage again these policies and economic frameworks that are really defining our cities, is an ultimate sort of urgency. Finally, I would say that it was interesting in terms of the Biennale to see how the same camps began to be polarized, in fact. I was sort of really uneasy about the whole thing. It might as well have been that Aaron Beske was McCain and Emiliano was, Obama, because and you could see where 90% of the budget went into when the Arsenale, I called it the Arsenale's show, I called it the longest boutique hotel lobby lounge, and seeing one after the other these super expensive installations that ultimately, when I was realized that the world is burning somehow, out there, at this very moment, architects are indulging in this really excessive project of, producing these installations that, at least for me, we're not really talking about the issue. So that's what I mean. I'm not, in a way, I can criticize my own field. That's not to say, bothered by star architects. No, it's just that, everybody's doing what they have to do, what we have to do. What bothers me is how our field has been absent from the engaging the very conditions that are that there is a sense of urgency, I think, at this moment where we need to participate in a very different paradigm.
Yeah, but also because besides the absence of the architects is also following somehow the lack of tools that the architect has to get engaged. Like if you consider that nowadays, and these are data from UN Habitat, one person over five in the world lives in a slum, so an informal, in a illegal town, auto-constructing its own shelter. And in 2025, it's going to be one over three. And how our cities, like with the sprawl, becoming more and more indefinable, we as architects don't usually have, in traditional sense, the tools to understand, to read this transformation, and actually to get involved with it. So what is happening is that the architects are called more and more simply to design the skin of a development. So the developer decides something, the municipality usually is designing a general zoning, and then the architect is called just to make, the most shiny facade of it. So the thing is this, how do you define a tool in which it gets, in which you can get involved in designing really the structure of the city? So what was happening 50 years ago was usually that architects were designing visions, so a grand plan that in which all the city or the neighborhood will take form, and everybody will have one role in this development. Well, what we're seeing now is that no one is even strong enough, not even a municipality, to design how the city will become, because there's too many components that are conflicting. So what is, I think, really interesting of the work of Teddy and a lot of the protection and actually all of the works that you're showing in the American Pavilion is that these people are really defining new tools, first to understand the emergencies of the cities, of the urban conditions in several places, and actually also to define tools in which you can engage people to understand actually what could be urgent for them and what can they do to change things. Because, of course, the architect is only one person, and it's a person that is just somehow a mediator between a civil society, so a citizenship, and the politician. So this mediation means that the architect is the person that can understand the local condition and go to the politician and express these problems. So What is interesting is then exactly defining methods that could be methods for collective change that can get people involved in a kind of bottom-up process to change. And that's something that has to be done in a completely open and collective way, because it's not something that can be forced somehow.
In that sense, I think that there is a questioning of the perennial kind of topic of innovation when it comes to a biennale, let's say, and showing the best projects and the new and most sort of alternative works. Initially, when we were thinking about the U.S. Pavilion, one desire was to, in fact, fill it not with American work. Of course, the State Department didn't go for it, but with actually works coming from the Global South.
Yeah.
Because what we're saying, reality, yes, we need to produce new works, but at the same time, there has to be an understanding that already amazing projects have emerged in the Global South out of social emergency.
Yeah, we felt that Teddy's doing a project where in Guatemala or
Nicaragua.
Nicaragua. That this developed world could learn from the developing world, but the State Department wouldn't allow us to do that. So.
Well, the issue was that exactly with these tools or retooling or the best practices that have emerged. I mean, so many books have been written about Curitiba, for example, in Brazil, but no one has really told the story. What really happened behind that project? What procedures of negotiation between top-down and bottom-up, between formal and informal, social activism, and more kind of utopian type of sort of top-down vision from the government? I mean, there was a really interesting project there. And to really translate that process into a set of, well, almost like the work that you showed of the Spanish architect, certain recipes that can be replicated in other localities by changing or shifting the stakeholders and the institutions, but nevertheless, how can we in a biennale exchange templates of knowledge that can ultimately be deployed in different ways? I think that continues to be somehow up for grabs, mainly in an international exhibition where, as you might know, or the exhibition is really about displaying objects, displaying images, but very seldom really the exchange of knowledge occurs there. So I think that was another aspect that became important in the discussion.
Yeah, it's interesting that the Biennale, the talk is, I heard the same thing when I started the Architects newspaper. Everybody said the news is all on the web, and when I started a newspaper, would seem to be very old-fashioned. Everything seems to be on the web, but yet this thing that happens in the space of Venice, I mean, I guess it's partially done because it supports Venice, which is kind of a dying city, but it actually, people get in fights about this stuff and they engage with it, and it's in this space, which is what architects are all dealing with. I thought it's an incredible, some of us get really angry, it costs a lot of money to do this, and we see all the stuff we hate. There were people I had some people from the Arsenale who came in, looked at the Marriott Pavilion and said, oh yeah, this is really nice. They just like walked right out the door. You could tell they just hated it. It was very passionate. So in the space of this garden, there's a lot of debate and discussion and anger and fights and all kinds of things that ended up in gossip columns and newspapers, architecture newspapers all over the place. But it's an amazing event if you ever get a chance to go. I don't know what's going to happen with the next one. It'll either make you so angry about architecture or, I don't know, maybe it'll be exciting. But it's kind of an amazing phenomena, to go through all of this stuff and have all these people there judging you. On the day it opens.
It seems like a great end note. I have many questions for all of you, but before Teddy and Emiliano have to run to the train, I thought maybe we could open it up if you have some questions for them.
Some of the examples you showed were more about the adaptation or some of you at the beginning, even subversion, and I was wondering what do you feel is the architect's role in empowering people. I mean, it seems, I guess, one of the things in the chart that really touched on that was maybe neighborhood as developer, or maybe as organizer, but I was wondering if you could speak to sort of the empowerment or sort of empowering certain citizens as a designer.
I'll talk, I think mostly in the example of Santiago Surugueda, it's really the idea of defining a way in which you can empower people. So people won't be empowered by your work as an architect very much. So what Santiago is doing is actually he's using his way to work in between art institutions, because he's also working as an artist, and this kind of very subversive actions mostly to get the attention of the media on the problem. So the empowerment is, it's not about solving the problem of housing with this project, but it's about first talking with a lot of people and with the community that is going to actually be engaged in doing this. So that's the first enrollment. And then raising the discussion about these issues, about the problems that you're facing within the larger scope. What is interesting is that, so the architect is actually starting the process, and with starting the process, he's trying to raise awareness about it. So getting the first page of a local newspaper gets much more attention than any kind of work you can do by yourself. So that's a way of a momentum that you can create around the problems and the problematics.
A lot of the groups in our pavilion were doing education on a different level. There's CUP, which teaches in middle schools in Bushwick, called, did a project, Follow the Money Trail, where they're explaining to kids who are 12 and 13 who owns their neighborhood, which is a really incredible thing. And then Rural Studio came out of Auburn. Teddy, you know, teaches in schools. The Studio 804 came out of the University of Kansas. They're all very much involved with education on a really interesting level.
It's interesting because it's been said, of course, that the global warming is just being reduced to an environmental crisis. But in reality, it's fundamental that we understand that it's really about a cultural crisis. And the need for a transformation of certain institutions, whether that's pedagogy, all the way to the politics of development and economic, you know, development in a neighborhood. So this issue of empowerment suggests that. I mean, for example, Ted Smith in San Diego, that has been referred to and was in the show, he's been empowering students of architecture to become developers of their own work. He said, why do you have to wait for a developer to give you a proforma that you would just decorate with your nice architecture, which is really my dissatisfaction with the flocking of the profession in the avant-garde to Dubai and China, is that they are just unconditionally decorating, camouflaging huge projects of gentrification, privatization beneath this hyper-stylistic formalism. And no questions asked. Who owns, again, these projects? So Ted Smith is saying the proforma itself of the developer is a site of intervention in our time, and how you can realize as an architect that your fees are already are equity towards a construction loan. That began to change the things in San Diego very much. And ultimately, in terms of a neighborhood, is to realize that no advances in affordable housing can be achieved at this very moment without advances, again, in housing policy and in housing lending. So as architects, I think we need to enter the structures that lending is sort of framed by, whether mortgages or tax credits, all the way to the zoning that precludes certain densities and mixed uses from happening. So I think that's what I mean by empowering, is just to enter the kind of rigidity of stupid institutions, to really open them up and to really understand what is behind them. And that becomes a material, I think, for the architect.
We can keep this discussion going, but is there one more question for either Emiliano or for Teddy before they have to leave?
You've invoked Beijing and Dubai as big patrons and architects as entrepreneurs. My question is, if the spirit of Louis Mumford got it right now, who would he say would be the communist government to work for? Do you see anybody as doing patronage or other than grassroots? Do you see any place that you can take this work for governments that are sympathetic?
In essence, I mean, it's not to say again, even though I might be complaining because I haven't gotten any commission in China. yes, I mean, that's a viable situation. I mean, there are, after all, really interesting works emerging. I mean, it's ultimately, again, things have to occur in certain ways. But while everybody is looking with incredible desire towards these centers of economic power, I think we as a profession, or as an institution of architecture and urbanism, can also look at other sites. In this case, I'm talking about, again, those sites of conflict from within, because within and through those conditions, probably more experimental architectures could be, you know, could emerge. And somehow I think in that case, at least for me, I mean, many other people might talk differently about this, but the neighborhood has become the site of intervention. I've many times say the neighborhood is the laboratory of our time, because it is there where many very progressive social service organizations, NGOs and so on, have been redefining ways of doing housing by acting as mediators between social capital and economic capital and so on. So these alternative sites of intervention from which other procedures might emerge. So in that sense, our clients, let's say, our others, and ultimately ourselves. We could be entrepreneurs of our own, you know, work by, as Ted Smith says, becoming developers ourselves.
Here at Slot Foundation, one of the things that we tried to take from the Biennale was a series of kind of insights into how these projects could be mobilized on the ground here in Philadelphia. And what I mean by that is it's really a pleasure to be able to speak to this. Teddy was here yesterday and today for a series of meetings with People's Emergency Center, a really remarkable Philadelphia social services organization and community development corporation just a few blocks away. And so we're at the very start of a process in keeping with the kinds of projects we've been talking about tonight, to see what could be built just nearby here on a full city block, trying to imagine a mixed-use, mixed-income development. And so hopefully, the ideas that we've been exploring in the Biennale will also play out here in Philadelphia, and we'll be seeing a lot more of Teddy and Bill and Emiliano as well. So on that note, again, Bill and I can stay. We'd love to continue the conversation with all of you, with David, with Lindsay, with Annette, with everybody. But Emiliano and Teddy do have to go to the train, so thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.